time for a newcomer ask. We leave this box in the back of the room along with some 3x5 cards and some pencils. And what we'd like to have you do is, if you have questions about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you write your question down, put it in the box here. We select the question to be answered tonight in front of the group using AA-approved literature and our own panel of experts. Tonight's question will be answered by Valley Group's own Lee.
Hi, I'm Lee, and I'm an alcoholic. The question is, how much sobriety time should you have before you sponsor somebody else? I thought I heard when I first came in here there was something about 6 months or 3 months. Until I've been with my sponsor for, I'd say, probably 3 months, and we were working, I think, step six or seven. And he asked me the same question. He goes, what would you do if somebody asked you to be a sponsor? And I said, well, tell them I need 6 months before I can be a sponsor. And he gave me a little dirty look and said, no, that's not the right answer. He said, are you saying that you're unwilling to share what I've taught you? And I said, no. And he goes, what would have happened if Bill and Bob would have waited 6 months before they sponsored anybody? We wouldn't have AA today. So there's no real time frame. The main thing is that you've worked, if you haven't worked a step, you can't teach anybody this step, right? So until somebody's taught you, you need to be a few steps ahead of the person you want to teach. I'd also like to point you towards this great pamphlet here, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship. It has all kinds of information about how you pick your sponsor, how you trust the guy or the girl, all kinds of stuff. And that's it.
Thank you, Lee. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. So now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 12/24 of 1989. He has been a member of groups in both San Diego and Fresno, where he has been in service as a secretary. He formerly had the unique habit of drinking beer in the shower, which I'm sure he will be only too happy to explain to you. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Steve D.
My name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. And I guess I should explain drinking beers in the shower. When the young lady said, go to the nearest bathroom, okay, I felt right at home. Okay? You just made me feel so at home. But it's true, you know. I used to really love drinking cold beers in the shower, and they had to be cold beers, you know, because you get that cold beer in the hot shower, and it just kind of froths up, you know. It gets the beads of sweat on it, and I just used to love that. Usually it was because, you know, I was getting ready to go someplace, you know, because I'm taking a shower, I'm getting ready to go someplace, I'm having a beer, and, you know, it's going to get exciting. And but I used to love to drink beers in the shower. And then, you know, when I sobered up, I had this real difficult dilemma. I tended to think of myself as a social drinker. Okay, I tended to think that, you know, I drink a lot, yeah, I end up drunk, yeah, I do stupid stuff, yeah, I feel guilty about it, but, you know, really, I'm just kind of a social drinker, you know, I drink at social events. when I sobered up and I started talking about my drinking habits, you know, guy pointed out to me, you know, that usually drinking in the shower was not a social event, you know, and usually, and so I had to kind of, yeah, okay, you know, that makes sense, but anyway, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I got sober. It was Christmas Eve of 1989. I was 21 years old. A couple more years, I was going to be, or a couple more months, I was going to turn 22. So it was right before I turned 22. I was living in San Diego. I was home visiting my parents in Fresno. It was Christmas vacation. And I had done what I had tended to do at that point. Towards the end of my drinking, I had gone out for a couple of days. I made it to their house, I think, on the 22nd. And then I went out. I went out, and a couple of days later, I came back on the 24th. And in that span of time, I had done a lot of things that I swore I'd never do. I had crossed more lines that I told myself I would never cross. And I remember driving back to their house on Christmas Eve morning with all of this guilt. I don't know if anybody else ever felt that guilt the morning after. Okay. But I used to feel that guilt a lot. And because I was a blackout drinker, I should tell you that. You know, ever since I started drinking, which was, I think junior high was the first time I got drunk. I drank a lot through high school and then college, and then I got sober when I was 21. And from the very beginning, I used to black out. It kind of spooked me at first, the whole blacking out thing. But then I got to understand that if I drank, this is the way I rationalized it, okay, was that if I drank enough to black out, that meant I had a good time. Okay? If I drank enough to black out, that meant I had a good time, and there were probably some hijinks that happened and some stories that my buddies were going to fill me in on the next morning. Okay? And so it really didn't, you know, I just thought it was kind of par for the course. But that morning I was driving back to their house. There were bits and pieces that I could not remember. The worst part were those bits and pieces that I could remember. And I had this feeling that really wasn't that different from other mornings or other times when I'm kind of sobering up and I'm coming down or whatever. Okay? And I realized all the things that I had done. You know, and one thing that, you know, I'd like to tell you is that about myself, my childhood, is that, you know, I came from a family. My parents are still married, okay? You know, they're going to celebrate 50 years of marriage, I don't know, in a couple of years, okay? They're still married. I don't come from a broken home. My parents never abused me. They were both pretty successful people, high-functioning people. I don't have a good solid reason to rebel. I don't have a good solid reason to go get drunk, use drugs, or whatever. You know, I don't have that. You know, I just have this. The way it was explained to me after I got sober is I have this restless irritableness and discontentedness, and that's part of my alcoholism. And so I'm driving back to these people's homes that are really nice people, you know, and I had done all of these things, and those mornings, those thoughts would just come flooding back, and you know, my friend Johnny says that it's like a slideshow in my head, and I can always relate to that when he says that, you know. It was like a slideshow. I'm driving back there, and getting these slides of all the things that I had done and things that I felt really guilty about. And so I get back to the house, and I walk in their house, and they're sitting at the kitchen table. It's breakfast time. And the thing I noticed is that neither one of them looked up. You know, I walk into the house, I walk in, and neither one of them could look at me. I'm an only child, okay? So I'm real needy, okay? I'm real high maintenance when it comes to my parents. You know, they've spoiled me rotten, and I'm this only spoiled child. And so when I walk into their house, and they can't even look at me anymore, you know, I lost it. I lost it, you know. And I, for the first time, began to tattle on myself. And I tattled on myself for the things that I had done. Some of the things that I had done the night before. I began to tattle on myself for some of the things that I had been doing for the last couple years. I told them that I thought I had a problem, you know. And I got to be honest with you people. I used to use that line a lot. I use that line a lot with girlfriends. Okay? I use that line a lot with teachers. I use that line a lot with authority figures that when I thought I was going to be in trouble, I would fess up and I would say, you know, I think I have a problem. You know, I was always working off of people's sympathies. You know, I was always trying to, I had no intention of doing anything about it. You know, I had no intention of doing anything about my problem, but I had discovered that if I told you that I thought I had a problem, you probably were going to be a little bit more lenient with your anger towards me. Okay? And so I tried that on them. I told them I thought I had a problem. And the thing that kind of messed up my plan was that they took action on it. You know, a lot of times, roommates, girlfriends, I could say that and they would just, oh, that's okay. You know, you're okay. And, you know, and it would just kind of blow over. I was always relieved when the tornado blew over, okay? You know, when we just waited out, everything was going to be okay. But, you know, they weren't going to wait it out. And so my dad made a couple of phone calls. I ended up going to a treatment center that was in Clovis, just outside of Fresno. At that time, it was called the ARC. And they had an inpatient and they had an outpatient. It was Christmas vacation. And so I was real busy, you know. I had a lot of stuff that I had to take care of. And this whole inpatient thing, I wasn't too sure about. Okay. I walked in with my parents. They took me to the place. They made the phone call. They drove me over there. They took me in. And this lady who looked like she was just the perkiest thing I'd ever seen came bouncing out into the lobby and greeted us. And told me, this is going to be your best Christmas ever. And I just wanted to throw up on her, okay? I just, you know, you don't know me. Okay, you don't know me. You don't know, you know. And so I tolerated her perkiness. And we had our interview. And she recommended the inpatient thing, and I immediately said, you know, I got a lot of stuff I got to do, you know. And I had no friends in Fresno, but I had a lot of stuff I had to do. So I weaseled my way into doing the outpatient deal. And the outpatient was you met every day, every evening, and they had this deal with they had the alcoholics and the drug addicts, and then they had the families, and then they would come together, and then anyway, long story short, right? I went through that program. They gave me all the books, you know. They gave me a big book. They gave me a 12 and 12. They gave me a daily reflections, a couple of daily reflections books, and. And that was the start, you know, that was the start of it. I forget how many days the program was, but it came to the point where I had to go back to school. I was going back to school in San Diego, and so I informed them that I couldn't go through the whole program, that I was going to leave early. And the people in the group, you know, I'll always remember this, the people in the group, you know, they kind of go around and they share. And the big concern was,
we think you're going to drink. You should make your sobriety your top priority. Okay? Everything else comes secondary. You should make the sobriety your top priority. You should stay here with us and not go back to school, you know? And just like that perky lady, you know, I tolerated it. And that was my first big resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous, in sobriety. Okay? That was my first big resentment, you know, because what they said and what I heard were probably two entirely different things. They were probably telling me that we're really concerned about you. You've come a long way, and we want you to succeed. You got to make your sobriety. But what I heard was, you know what, dumbass? You are so pathetic. Without us, you're not going to make it. That's what I heard. You know, and I'm pretty sure that's not what they said. You know, but that's what I heard. And so that was my first big resentment. And so I left, and I, you know, and I'm going, and I'm going to make it, you know. To damn with them, I'm going to make it. I'm going to stay sober just to spite those people. And I, you know, I have to be honest with you. I think that first year, my first year of sobriety, a large part, there were two things, I think. Two things that were in the back of my head that kept nagging me. One were those people at that treatment center that thought I was going to relapse. Okay. No, screw them. Okay, I'm going to stay sober. The second thing was that morning that I fessed up to my parents, my father looked me in the eye and he said, "Son, never, ever forget how you feel at this moment." Because at that moment, I felt about that big. Okay. I had begun to tattle on myself. I had begun to divulge some of the dark secrets that I was carrying, some of the behaviors that I was doing. I had divulged to them more than I had intended to. And I felt about that thing. And he could see it. And he said, "Don't ever forget the way you feel right now, because there's going to come a day that you're going to feel pretty good. There's going to come a day that you're going to feel like you've got your act together. And it's going to be real easy to forget." And so, you know, I think those two things are really what kept me sober my first year of sobriety. It's those two things that kept going through the back of my mind. Those two things. I went back to school. I finished up. I was so stoked on myself and so proud that I had gotten sober that I decided to continue with school, and I went immediately into a master's program, and I was going to get a degree in counseling because I knew that there were some real, real sick people out there that could use my experience, strength, and hope, okay? I knew I had a lot to offer, okay? And so I started doing that, and I found myself working for a couple of Catholic nuns at the university. And I was working in the Office of Alcohol and Drug Education at the University of San Diego, and I was working with students, and I was telling them about the evils of their ways, and I had charts and graphs, and I was, you know, pointing and diagnosing people and everything. And then one day, one day, the nun, the head nun, called me into her office, and I had about a year of sobriety at this time. She called me into her office, and she says, "You know, Steve, we're real happy for you, you know. We're real proud of you, you know, that you seem to have straightened up and you're not drinking. You know, you needed to stop drinking, and real glad that you stopped. The problem is that you really haven't changed your behavior." "Problem is you really haven't changed your behavior. You know, I see you doing a lot of the same things." And, you know, granted, this woman really knew me well, okay?
I didn't know her on a personal level until I sobered up. What I had come to find out after I sobered up is that she had a file with my name on it. Okay? She had been counseling a lot of my friends that had been going to her saying, you know, I got this friend that really needs some help. What do I do? And she had a file. Okay? And so when I made that phone call, they were expecting my call. You know, and that's the other thing that amazes me about my alcoholic thinking. When I was drinking, I thought that I was really kind of managing things pretty well. I don't know about any of you. Okay? I really thought that I was managing things well, you know, because I had a lot of separate lives going. I had the drinking friends. I had the friends that did illegal substances. I had the work friends. I had the school friends. I had all these different lives. You know, I had this girlfriend. I had those roommates. I had all these different lives. And they had all, I had told them all different stories. Okay? And so it was a real, real effort to keep all the stories straight and remember who was carrying what story, you know. The analogy that, you know, I'm not going to get too much use out of this analogy anymore, you know. There was once a movie called Ghostbusters. Okay? There's a scene in there where they've got the streams, they're trying to capture the ghosts, you know, and they've got the streams, and, you know, and the big thing is don't cross the streams. Because if the streams cross, everything gets messed up. Okay? That's the way my life was. Okay? My life was like these streams that I just prayed would never cross, you know, so that everything wouldn't get messed up. So, talking to the nun, right? That's where I was, right? I was talking to the nun. And, you know, she knew me really well. She had a file on me. She knew my hijinks. She knew all the, you know, some of the things that I was doing. And she just flat out told me, you know. And so, you know, I've never cussed at a nun before until that moment. Okay. And I had some choice words for her, and I stormed out of her office, you know. That's the other thing I did really well, okay? I would throw fits, okay? When I was drinking, I threw a lot of fits, you know. I distinctly remember, you know, getting in a fight, you know, riding in the car with my girlfriend, getting in a fight, right? I don't know what it was about. Just a drunken fight, drunken argument. And get to the stoplight, and you know what? Piss off. And I get out, I'm going to punish her by walking home. It makes a lot of sense, right? I'm going to punish her by walking home. Okay. Well, I punished the nun by walking out of her office, you know, and threw a little fit. And then I realized that I was throwing a little fit, and that's what I used to do when I drank. And I began to realize, you know what, she's right. Because I still had those separate lives. I still was trying to manage all that stuff. And so that's when I really started to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was trying to stay sober that first year with self-knowledge. You know, they told me all this stuff in rehab. That's all you really need to know, right? You know, I was studying all this stuff in school. You know, I probably, you know, I like to think that I knew more than the average Joe. I was lecturing to these students for crying out loud, you know? And yet, my behavior hadn't changed, and my alcoholic, what I came to understand as my alcoholic thinking hadn't changed. And so I listened to her, and I began going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was always real nervous, you know. Last night, my home group is the Village group in Fresno. Those two guys are my ride. Fresno, California. I've been going to that meeting consistently for 20 years. I moved to Fresno when I had 2 years of sobriety, and I found that meeting, and I've consistently been a member in good standing, I guess, for 20 years. One of the things that really scared me about Alcoholics Anonymous was that you people had a way of looking through me and seeing the truth. When I would show up and I would start to talk and I would start to tell you about my day and tell you about this and that, the old timers kind of, it was like they looked right through me and they just chuckled, you know? And I remember a guy saying once something that really scared me. The guy said, you know, I can always tell by the way someone shares if they've got a sponsor or not. And that scared me. You know, and the only reason that scared me is because I thought I was sounding really good without a sponsor. And, you know, my point is this, is that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they could see right through me, yet they humored me. They could see right through me. You know, they could see right through all my BS. They knew that I had this crazy, insane alcoholic mind, and I was trying to manage it. And they would just laugh, and they would tell me to keep coming back, you know. One of the things that I always appreciated in my early sobriety when I was new was when people would talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was 21 years old. I hadn't lost a lot of things that people around here talk about losing. I had never been arrested. I didn't have a DUI. I didn't lose a family or children. I didn't lose a job, you know. And so I could never relate to those things. But the one thing that I could relate to is the thing that I can still relate to today is when people talk about what happens after that first drink. Okay. For years, I had not understood the connection between the first drink and getting drunk. You know? And if I think back through the years of my drinking, there was never a time when I thought, you know, I've had a couple, I'm starting to feel it, I should probably slow down. That never entered my thought, okay? I would start drinking, and I remember before I would take that drink, I would have the thought, okay, Steve, tonight we're going to try and keep things in control. That was my way of, you know, we're going to try keep things in control, okay? But I would start drinking in San Diego, and I would wake up in Rosarito, okay? I had a friend my roommate's girlfriend's parents, okay, had a trailer down in Rosarito, and I knew where the keys were, okay? And for some reason, I would start drinking, and I would wake up there. And that, I did that a lot. You know, my parents, when I was in college, my parents moved to Maine. And so I would go visit them in Maine. And I would start drinking in Maine and wake up in New Brunswick, which is Canada. Okay? I got this strange thing with borders, you know? And I would have these ideas, you know, I'm going to try and keep it all together. I'm going to try and keep it all together. Okay, I'm going to have a few, but I'm not going to become ugly. You know, when I first started drinking, I really loved the fact that I was getting away with something that I shouldn't be doing. I loved the fact that there would be an adventure involved. Because I get drunk and I have bright ideas. I get these bright ideas, you know, that let's go someplace. You know, you're driving, you know, and let's take your ATM card and let's, you know, I would start to have these bright ideas, and there would be, and then the story would, you know, I could never stick to my original plan of keeping things, you know, not letting things get out of control. I would give myself pep talks while I'm in the shower drinking my beer. I would give myself pep talks. Okay, so you're going to keep it together. And if you get drunk, you're not going to say mean things. You're only going to say nice things, nice things, nice things, you know. And I do a little meditation, nice things, and I could never stick to it, okay? You know, when I started drinking, one of the things that I liked was the unpredictability, you know, of what was going to happen. But towards the end of my drinking, that lack of predictability would drive me nuts. I could no longer predict who I was going to be when I drank, what I would turn into, what type of bright ideas I would have, where I would end up. And like I said at the beginning, you know, my parents raised me, you know, with morals, you know. They raised me knowing the difference between right and wrong. You know, I've always been able to pretty much discern the difference between right and wrong. My problem is that I've got these great powers of rationalization. I've got these insane powers of justification. And I can turn anything into a way of rationalizing what I want, you know? But my behavior started to become too much for me to handle. My behavior, the results of my behavior, started to become too much for my mind to handle. The only thing that would take that away would be to get drunk. And so towards the end of my drinking, I found myself in the cycle that the book talks about, you know, that thing that's causing my problems is the solution to my problems. And I couldn't figure out how to get out of that. You know, alcohol, I get to be honest with you, alcohol was a great thing in my life. It was a wonderful thing in my life. Getting drunk, drinking, turns my mind off like nothing else. It instantly changes my perception. What I've come to learn is my alcoholism, my restlessness, irritableness, and discontentedness is rooted in my perception. You know, my sponsor talks about this. I've heard tapes by Clancy talking about perception, and that alcoholism is a disease of perception, and I've always been able to relate to that. I can always relate to people when people talk about the insanity of the alcoholic mind, you know, and they talk about what happens after having that first drink. And so my first couple years were filled with, I have no idea where I am in my story, by the way, okay? I got 10 minutes. That's where you are in your story. You've got 10 minutes. So, so 10 minutes, 20 years of sobriety in 10 minutes. Okay. I don't know. I've been thinking an awful lot lately about what I felt like when I was new. That's why I kind of went all into that, because I felt absolutely batshit crazy. I was just nuts. I was a nut job, nut job, nut job. I thought I had Tourette's, okay? I thought I had Tourette's when I was new, because I would get these flashes of things that I had done, and I would, you know, and then people would say things in meetings, and I would just, what? you know, how can you say that? I did that, you know? And, I mean, it was just, I was totally nuts. I was just, I was insane, you know? And I think that has to do with my love of drinking. You know, I was talking about what alcohol does for me, shuts my brain off. When I was sober and I was insane like that, I had nothing to shut off that brain. I had nothing to shut off all of that insanity. And it was tough. Though, you know, I was so impressed tonight with the line of people taking chips. You know, I thought, I think that's amazing. You know, this is my second time to this meeting, and I'm always real impressed with how involved everybody is. You know, with the greeters and the giving chips and the readings, you know, I really enjoyed listening to the readings tonight, you know, and, you know, part of the reason that I enjoy that is because it's not my thought. It doesn't come naturally for me to open up the big book. Okay, I need to have those things imposed on me from time to time. When I was new, I used to cling on almost every word people were saying, because I thought in something somebody says is going to be the secret that I need. If there's some magic tidbit, somebody's going to say it, you know, and if I just listen long enough, I'm going to catch it. Okay? And then maybe I don't have to come to AA anymore. Okay? With my thinking. Okay? If I gotta get that secret. And so I used to really pay attention when I was new. I really had no idea what people were saying, but I really paid attention, you know? One of the things that I've noticed for myself, the longer I stay sober, the harder it is for me to pay attention. And I think, you know, I've heard people say it over the years, that the longer I stay sober, I have to do twice as much work to reap half the benefits. For a guy that really didn't want to be in AA, that's kind of a tall order, okay? Because I really didn't want to do anything when I got here. And so, but I know what they're talking about, you know? I see that, I understand that, you know? I get this. The way I know that I'm still an alcoholic is that I start to think that I know what's best for me. You know, it's funny. Every time in sobriety when I have a crisis, I'm very, very willing to do whatever you tell me to do. If things aren't going my way, if I lose a job, if I lose there's a breakup, if I lose a friend, if there's a death in the family, whatever it is that I'm dealing with in sobriety, I'm real willing to listen to what you have to tell me, you know, and I'm willing to go to any lengths, you know. When I was in my parents' kitchen, I was willing to go to any lengths. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. The problem is that perception comes back. And I want to start running the show. And so when things are good are the times that it's most dangerous for me. When things are tough, okay, those are the times I take you up on your advice. And whenever I have listened to your people's advice, my life has gotten better. I can't think of one time in my sobriety when I have listened to my sponsor's advice, I've taken some action, and my life got worse. Every single time, you people have put my life back together. Okay? In that amount of time, 22 years, there have been ups and downs. Life, it happens. But you people have continued to put my life back together. You've continued to make me feel like I'm enough. You've continued to make me feel like there's a place for me in this world and that I am important to somebody. You know, when I, towards the end of my drinking, I did not have those feelings. I felt real alone. I felt real ashamed. And you people, you know, you continue to work on me. The things that worked when I was new are the same things that work for me today.
I read the book, talk to my sponsor, I work the steps, and I pray. Those are the same things you told me when I was new. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really want to welcome you. And I want to tell you that for a guy that didn't plan on staying, Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best thing that has ever happened in my life. I cannot imagine the quality of relationships that I have today. I cannot imagine my style of life today. I cannot imagine the peacefulness that I experience from time to time without Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new, please keep coming back and give it a shot. Thank you.